It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, I'm in one of my favorite places right now, at a coffee shop, and there'll be some noise of the coffee shop around us from time to time, and because they roast coffee here too. But what's really unusual for me is I'm having an opportunity to talk to somebody today who's a coffee farmer in a coffee shop. And Juan, I didn't tell you this, but I had your coffee out here just before we came in here, grabbed the microphones. So I'm glad to welcome Juan Luis Barrios from Guatemala. Juan, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to the talk, and I'm hoping you very much enjoyed the coffee.
I did enjoy the coffee. You know, the thing is, I can never remember what are the things that describe the differences of the coffee. And this coffee from Guatemala, compared to sometimes I've been in here, I've had some coffee from Brazil. I've had some coffee from, I think, the Honduras and Mexico. Is there something about Guatemalan coffee that that you can usually tell that it came from Guatemala from tasting it rather than some of the other countries that are producing coffee?
That's a good question. It's also a little bit of a tough one because that is one of the beauties of coffee, that it depends a lot on the varietal. It depends a lot on the microclimate. So there will be some regions of Guatemala that may have some distinct flavors. Like, for example, Antigua is well known for its brightness, meaning its acidity on the palate. The area of Huehuetenango is going to have some very strong fruit flavors in it. But then once you get, like, let's say at the farm level, like mine, then it's going to depend a little bit on, again, the varietals, the microclimate, and also the processing and the roasting. The coffee that we send up to Chocolate Fish, we try to make sure it's one of the sweet ones, a dark chocolate aftertaste, the citrus acidity that you can feel in there.
So you send coffee all over the world from your farm in Guatemala, and I think you said you're going to Norway after you're through up here in California. Is there a difference in their palates and what they're looking for in the coffees that you send them, and if you're going to Scandinavia versus California?
Yes, actually, different customers in different parts of the world have different preferences. For example, our Norwegian customers, they like the coffee with a little bit more fruit flavors and a little less brightness. So one in the varietals that I pick and also the way I process it, I try to get those flavors into the coffee versus the one that we send up here because, Chocolate Fish, they have a different palate for their markets.
Chocolate Fish is going to sound unusual to some people. That's actually the name of the coffee shops, and I've talked to them before, and they've got some wonderful coffees here, and they have a way of helping walk you through choosing the coffees. But I am going to remember yours because I did like it especially. Describe for people what it's like where your coffee is grown. So if I flew down there with you right now and we were going to jump in a car and go, do we go through heavy forest? Do we go up mountains? You know, what's the terrain like leading to where you're growing the coffee?
So we're in the central highlands of Guatemala, almost like right in the middle. So we would end up going up the mountain a little bit. The central highlands are more or less a plateau. So there's different plateaus throughout. So we will see, quite a bit of green growing around. Guatemala in general, most of our coffee is shade grown. In our case, we have a lot of shade with our coffees, and that's for climate reasons mainly. But it also helps in the maturation, the ripening of the coffee, and that's one of the things that helps influence the flavors.
Explain shade grown. Why does that matter? I mean, people see that in the coffee shops. about shade-grown coffee. Why is it good for coffee to be grown in shade?
So, you know, there's obviously there's shade-grown and there's non-shade-grown. One of the advantages of not having shade is you're going to have a lot more sunlight, so you may be able to increase your production per, we use hectares. So you may be able to increase your yield per hectare, and that's good for your pocket. But that's also going to speed up the metabolism of the plant. Whereas with shade, you slow down the metabolism. So you're probably going to be able to get a little bit more sugars into the seed, which is what we're actually drinking. And once it's roasted, you get a little bit more sweetness. And then the other factor is when we're talking about climate and where we're at, where we're at a relatively high elevation. We start at 5,750 feet and go as high as 6,300. So we're above a mile high. We have the risk of frost every year. And if I don't have shade trees, then you know my coffee trees are going to have frost the following morning. The sun comes up and is essentially going to burn the trees. So
really,
the shade trees have that mitigating factor as well.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Now you're close to the equator, right?
We're not that close. We're at parallel 14, 15.
So I mean, how hundreds of miles or?
You know, oh, wow, that's
I don't know. I mean, yeah. It's down that way. I mean, you're closer to the equator than we are. One of the reasons I ask is that with the effects of the climate getting hotter, I've had people talk about how it's, you know, production areas keep shifting. And here in California, up in Sacramento, in fact, they're saying like in 20-some years, we're going to have the same climate as Phoenix. So we'll have over 100 days over 100 degrees. But they've talked about, you know, down in Latin America that there's you're gonna see the effects of that sooner. Is it getting hot yet?
Well, more than getting hot, because we're in Central America and we have the Caribbean on one side, we've got the Pacific Ocean on the other. What we do see is with these shifts in rainfall patterns. So you have the El Nino effect, or you have the La Nina effect. So with these effects, we can actually get hit on both sides. So the rainfall patterns change. More than a change in temperature, it tends to be these rainfall patterns. And we have, for lack of a better term, freaky rainfall patterns, which we used to not have. So, you know, for us, you know, my grandfather, he planted the first coffee trees in 1912. And, you know, he could almost bank year in and year out. The rains would start roughly the 15th of May and end the 15th of October. And that's the way it was. And, you know, every, you know, 10, 15 years, you know, you had a freak phenomenon, which was either El Nino or La Nina. And nowadays, I mean, you can have El Nino one year, La Nina the next year, and then, you know, have one or two normal years, and then you have 2 years of El Nino. So, yeah, those are effects that we do start to see, and we've already started to see it over the last, you know, 5-7 years.
So when your grandfather started in Guatemala in 1912 with the coffee, did he have land available to him and saying, okay, it looks like other people are growing trees here, let's try coffee? Or how what have you heard about that process of things saying, okay, literally, this is where we're going to put a spade in the ground and we're going to have these coffee trees?
So the farm has actually been in the family since 1832.
Oh, wow.
And we've always had timber. So, you know, we've got pine trees and cypress trees. And back then they were growing black beans and corn. And my grandfather, you know, wanted to innovate, do something different. He had some friends in Antigua, which is about 35 miles south of where the farm is, and they had started growing coffee. And he said, well, you know, we got a climate relatively similar, so yep, why don't I, you know, try this? And that's how he started.
So since that time, have you largely stayed with the same varieties of coffee, or have they changed over these years?
By and large, we've stayed with roughly the same ones. I'm actually still harvesting the, you know, some of the original trees he planted in 1912, which, are in the coffee that we sell up here to Chocolate Fish. But yes, we've stayed with many of those same varietals because of the quality in the cup. They're not the highest yielding varietals. They are susceptible to disease, but we've focused more on quality. I have introduced additional varietals onto the farm, but this was a decision I took, you know, several years ago. I was going to focus on a quality product, not so much on productivity or disease resistance.
So you're getting flavors and you're breeding for those flavors. I tell you, it's so interesting to me to be standing here in a coffee shop and have the aroma of all the coffee around us as we're talking about coffee that started off in Guatemala and made it up here and on its way to Norway and every place else around the world. You know, walk us through this a little bit. So if you plant a tree, you go to nurseries that are, or do you get cuttings of some sort off of other trees? You don't start with seeds?
No, we do start with seeds. So coffee in general is done with seeds. So we will have a nursery, take care of them for almost a year. Well, actually a little bit over a year. And then they will eventually, you know, go on the ground and start to produce several years later, depending on where you are, your humidity levels, your elevation, etc. Coffee trees will usually start to produce between 3 to 5 years because we're a little bit higher up, a little bit drier. Once I plant a tree on the ground, by year 5, after planting, that's when it really starts to, you know, produce.
So you're looking for a spot that's shady. One of the things I can't get over the fact is that you're actually making a decision for flavor that possibly is costing you a little bit on yield, but you're sticking with the flavor decision. That's kind of unusual in commodity agriculture. And so you're picking some shady spots, a certain altitude. You're putting these trees in the ground when, what are they, like a foot and a half tall or something like that, if you've started them in the nurseries? And
No, they're much smaller. They will probably be around 10 inches tall, okay, roughly.
To get them in the ground, and how far apart are they?
So it will depend on the varietal. So you've got tall varietals, you've got short varietals. Also depends a little bit on how you want to manage it. And, you know, different techniques have been developed over the years, and there's different suggestions. So there isn't one recipe to what is ideal. You do have to look at your terrain. If you're going to have shade trees, if you're not going to have shade trees, if you're going to have shade trees, you know, what's the distance going to be with the shade trees? So there's a lot of factors that go into what's the ideal population. In hectares, in our case, we aim for 5,000 trees per hectare. Hectare is a little over 2 acres. Mm-hmm. And then the shade trees, it's not that we actually, you know, pick a shady area. We actually plant.
Oh, you plant the shade trees too.
Yes.
So you're growing the shade along with growing the trees.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yes.
And it takes you 3 years before you get any production, which I imagine is kind of light production at first, and then grow into what, maybe full production, 5 years, 6 years?
Exactly. Yeah.
And when do you harvest?
So most coffee growing areas will have only one harvest a year. There are a few areas around the world. There's a central section in Colombia, northeastern part of Guatemala. They will have harvest over a little bit of a longer period. It ends up being almost like full year round, but that has more to do with the rainfall patterns. In most of the tropics, which is where coffee is grown, we tend to have essentially two seasons, rainy and dry. So you will usually be harvesting during the dry season, and then during the rainy season is when you're having your bean development.
So water's not an issue for you. Then you've got all the water you need, or you have to irrigate too?
I would like to irrigate the years where we have El Nino. So for us, El Nino is going to be dry, even though up here El Nino is going to be wet. So it has that opposite effect depending on where you are located. So I would like to irrigate. It's just relatively impossible and economically also impossible. So when we have an El Nino effect or we have a prolonged drought during the rainy season like we had this year, there's really not a whole lot I can do other than wait to see what the effect is going to be.
You know, for some commodities and some products, the reward of having a bad weather year is better flavor years. I don't know if that's affected with coffee or not, but sometimes it seems like when plants are having to work harder, there's some more intensity in the flavors. Does that occur in coffee?
You know, that is something that has been mentioned, and there are some theories around that. It's just really hard to be able to scientifically prove it. Yeah. But yes, I would concur that years when you have slightly lower yields, or you know the plant is a little stressed for water, then yeah, you get some different flavors. That's for sure.
What about fertilizer? What do you need to apply to be able to get enough fertility to the plants?
So the way we do it, and we are a little bit ahead in that sense. So I do take soil analysis of 26 different sections around the farm every year. And depending on what the soil analysis is and what we project the harvest to be, that's, you know, the nutrition program is basically designed around that. So, you know, we have to add the nitrogen, the phosphorus, the potassium, and then, you know, micronutrients like calcium, magnesium, boron. So, yeah, it's...
And what about pests? Do you have to apply pesticides? There must be some bugs that like to get into havoc in the coffee.
Yes, because where we are in the higher elevation and cooler temperatures, normally pests are not that big of an issue for us, at least nothing that's going to be have an economic effect. So we roughly just let it be. We do have problems with some types of fungus. So yes, we do have to apply some type of fungicide, whether that's either an organic fungicide or a chemical fungicide, depending on which part of the growth cycle we're in. Because towards as we get closer to harvest, I'll move into an organic because I want to try to make sure there's no residuals in the coffee.
Yeah, you just mentioned a Beatles song a second ago there, Let It Be. And so it made me think of bees. So are they necessary? Do you need pollinators for coffee?
So there's two types of coffee commercially general. So you've got Robusta and Arabica. And so I only have Arabicas. And Arabica coffee self-pollinates roughly at 90%. So if you do have bees, then you help it out just a little bit. So we actually do have some. I wish I had more. But yes, we do have some, and they do help out.
Yeah, okay. So you get a crop, and what about the labor through the year? I imagine most of your labor needs are going to be coming at harvest time. Now, are you able to employ the teams you need, you know, full time, or are you able? You have to recruit just seasonally for the harvest?
Yes, for harvest, we do need seasonal workers. We will fluctuate somewhere between 125 to 140 pickers during the harvest. And then throughout the rest of the year, depending on which jobs we need, we will go anywhere from 20 to up to 80. So, yeah, depends a little bit. So when we're applying, for example, our fertilizer on the ground, we're going to need a few extra hands. And then there's other periods, and you know, during the year where we need a few less.
Do people live on the farms, or are they in the nearby villages? The workers you get for the harvest.
In our case, we were actually able to sell part of the land to workers who used to live on the farm. So we ended up selling them where they actually live in their houses. So now we're actually neighbors. So they are landowners. And obviously they have the option to come and work for us, which is good for them because then they can literally commute, go, you know, back home, not necessarily for lunch, but definitely, you know, breakfast and dinner, and then, you know, be able to sleep in their own bed.
Yeah. And then what do they do for the rest of the year? Are they small farmers too, or do they tend to have other part-time jobs with to supplement? I mean, when they're out harvesting, obviously they're busy. What do they do the rest of the time?
Yeah, so most of them will be small farmers. They will have some corn because corn is the base for tortillas, which is our version of bread. And, you know, that's a staple every day, three times a day. But we have seen a shift where they have moved out of corn and into coffee, where a few years back, coffee was being paid much better. So that we've seen that movement. And then others, of course, will have other side jobs. Some can be either fixed or temporary. So each family has their thing.
Now, I talked to somebody once about the coffee. They call coffee cherries, the fruit or the hull around the bean, which is a seed. Do you take those off? Do you have that available to you, that whatever they call it, the cherry or the hull?
Yeah, the we call it the pulp. Mm-hmm. Yes. So we call them cherries because they're round and red and they sort of look like cherries. So in the normal, let's say, what's called a washed coffee, what we will do is we will depulp. So we'll take the pulp off. And then the seeds, they have this protective, natural protective coating, which are complex sugars. And then those are fermented so that we can then wash them off. And that's why it's called washed coffee. Then you dry it and you dry the seed and bring it down to, you know, 10, 11% humidity level. And then that's ready for export. There are other processing methods where we actually don't take off the hull, and that's normally what's called a natural process. So we actually dehydrate the fruit around the seed, and then we don't take that off until it's ready for export.
That's amazing, amazing. And then do you use it for anything? Is it a feed or a fertilizer or anything, the ones that you remove?
So we do. We compost it. We actually apply efficient microorganisms to decompose it quickly and odorless. So, yeah, within 30, 40 days, it's completely composted. And then once the rainy season starts, that's what I use around the new trees that we planted. So we put that around the plant just to give it a little extra organic material there to help help it grow.
So you're sitting on a mountain of coffee in Guatemala, halfway up a hill somewhere, and now you got to market it all. And I suspect that you can't get by just selling your coffee in Guatemala. So you've got to market to the world. How do you approach that? We're in a coffee shop right now that is one of your partners. But how do you put a marketing plan and look at the world and say, we got to get out there around the world and sell these beans? How do you do that?
Well, it was one of the first lessons I learned in my MBA class, and it was basic marketing 101. And they said, okay, so you got to position yourself. Are you going to position yourself as a cost leader where you're going to be very efficient in your production, or you're going to have, for lack of a better term, a luxury item, and you're going to differentiate by quality? If you're in the middle, yes, you'll make money, but it's going to be a little bit harder. So knowing the areas of Brazil and knowing Vietnam was already online, there is no way I was going to be able to compete in volume and cost. The Guatemalan exchange rate plays, and in many of coffee exporting countries, the exchange rate plays a very important role. So from the get-go, I said, okay, I got to focus on quality. And I could do that because I already knew we had a good enough quality to be able to do that. So I focused on quality, and then I look for markets that are willing to pay for that quality. And it's not huge volumes. Everything is in relatively small batches. So it takes a little extra effort, and you got to travel and talk to people, and you send samples. And like anything in selling, I got to send 10 samples so that hopefully one says yes.
So where you are, where the farm is, do you have Braun Baden available? Can sit there and Google your coffee potential buyers around the world at the farm, or you got to go somewhere else to base to be able to get decent broadband?
Yeah, I have to do that from Guatemala City. So yeah, from the farm, cell phone service is a little bit better now, but yeah, not good enough to be able to do broadband. So I have to essentially do that out of Guatemala City, and then I have to go out and meet people and get in front of them and try to build relationships, because that's another important part of not only the selling process, but also being able to build these long-term relationships with our customers.
So when you look at that, then you're looking at potential customers around the world. And so do you literally, I mean, do you just like Google coffee shops or coffee roasters give them cold calls? What?
Well, we do have the advantage that there is a specialty coffee association, which is called the Specialty Coffee Association, and they have events in different parts of the world. There's two main events, one in the U.S., which goes into different cities every year, and then there's one in Europe, which also goes into different cities. So that's a great place to be able to network. Then within the Specialty Coffee Association, there's the Roasters Guild. So you can also access them and say, hey, you know, I'm looking for roasters, specialty coffee roasters in, you know, this area. You know, are you willing to either, you know, pass along my name, or can you give me a list? Or, you know, that's some type of networking through that as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I've seen around the country now, there are all sorts of coffee field days or events. I was in one in Cincinnati, and they were having the coffee weekend or something. I went down to it, and people were lined up around the block to get in and paying $10 to get in. And all the coffee shops in the metropolitan Cincinnati area were there, and roasters, and doing samples and passing out information about coffee. It was pretty interesting.
Yeah, those are great events, similar to San Francisco Coffee Festival this past weekend, this week Sacramento Specialty Coffee Week. So those are the types of events where you can also go out and, you know, as a grower, you can go out and meet.
So is that a Robert Parker of coffee, you know, that says it's great in a 94 or something like that? Because, you know, with wine, the wine enthusiast and all these others that are, and, you know, they're rating him this and that. Is there something like that for coffee?
There is something similar. There's a man by the name of Ken Davids. He has his own grading system, which is slightly different than what is generally the grading system used throughout the industry. So he does have a little bit of that for the U.S. market. It's not as widely used as, for example, a Robert Parker, though. So the slight difference with wine and coffee, which is what really fascinates me about coffee, is that even though I'm going to harvest, let's say, the same batch of beans, and then I will send them up to Chocolate Fish, and they will roast the same batch. But you want to have, let's say, a French press, and I want to have an espresso or an AeroPress. Out of the same bag of beans, it's going to be two completely different drinking experiences. So when you try to grade coffee, it's like, okay, but how did I grade it when you're talking about the general public? When, for example, a French press, you're going to have a coffee with a lot more body, and, you know, a coffee that's in an espresso, it's going to be a lot brighter. Mm-hmm. And it depends a little bit on your preference. And that's the beauty of coffee, where we can open the same bag of beans and have two completely different drinking experiences. And that's the only beverage I know of where you can actually do that, where you as a consumer have final say on your own drinking experience.
You know, when you look at the last couple of hundred years, you said your family goes back to raising coffees in the 1812s. Coffee has played a big role in helping people think up ideas of where the world was going. You know, you started with, like, back in the middle 1800s, the Vienna coffee shops were really known for, they had the people that ended up being very much the founders of capitalism, along with Karl Marx and others, hanging out at the same coffee shops. And it seemed like coffee makes you think. And there's been some campaigns like that too. It's a rich and varied environment around the world. Anymore here, like here at Chocolate Fish, we look around the corner and everybody's got their Mac computer up. And I've gone to some towns where I can kind of predict where I'm going to walk into a coffee shop that's all going to be Macs and the ones that are all going to be PC. And yet those kind of conversations go with coffee. I'm curious, as you go around the world and selling and marketing your coffee, what do you find that you find kind of interesting, or who has anyone has a unique coffee culture that you're really either intrigued by or find very appealing?
Well, there's different coffee cultures in many different parts of the world, and oftentimes, for example, even in the U.S., you have different coffee cultures within the U.S., and they're all interesting. I would say some of the most unique, the Japanese market. They have a large portion of their coffee consumption is in a ready-to-drink can or bottle. And what's actually very unique about that is that their society is built on such an honor system that you can find the vending machines on street corners throughout, and the vandalism rate is extremely low. It's much less than 1%. And that can only happen in a society that has that embedded in their culture. And that has allowed that format to, it's a coffee delivery system which works. And it's the only market I know of that has that. In contrast, for example, in Seoul, Korea, the amount of coffee shops there is like nothing else I've seen anywhere else in the world. And they are very individualistic in the sense that each person who is consuming coffee wants to identify with a different coffee shop. And these are like very small coffee shops, and oftentimes like they share a wall. So literally like right next door, it's a different coffee shop. And it's something very, very unique. And it's great because, again, people are experiencing coffee, all different sorts of coffee, roasted in many different ways and brewed in many different ways. So, yeah, that it's great to see.
Well, and you're on your way to Norway. What's that like? What's the coffee climate like there in Norway?
So they very much prefer brewed over espresso. In contrast, you go like just across the border into Sweden, and they are very much an espresso-based coffee drinking culture. And it's interesting that because we tend to want to generalize, say, oh yeah, the Nordic countries, they all drink it this way. But no, they are very much in the case of Norway, they like their brewed coffee.
Are they curious about the farming methods and the farmers all over the world, or is it more so in the United States?
I would say that Scandinavia in general are a little bit more interested on where the coffee is coming from. Is it being sustainably grown? Are coffee farmers being fairly rewarded for their work, for the quality of coffee? So yeah, I see that. There's other regions where it's not as prevalent, and that's okay.
I just wonder whether it's still to come, and I see those and I think, well, maybe some places are leading and others will be that way someday.
Well, being a farmer, yes, I'm hoping the entire world will one day, be a lot more aware of that, because most likely in a relatively short term, there will be some coffee growing areas which we will lose, because the commodity coffee price right now is not sustainable for a large portion of farmers.
That is such a story for so many commodities. that the biggest issue, and people say, well, we can produce this, we can produce more, we can produce the kind of qualities you want, and so forth, but the margins are extremely thin. And it seems like you could apply it to so many different agricultural commodities that people want to do this, but they may have to spend more than they've been spending. And yet, you know, when I stop at Choco Fish, I manage to get a couple of coffee drinks and a scone and spend $10, which seems like sort of extravagant. There was a time I wouldn't do that first thing in the morning, but it's not anywhere enough to be able to sort the system all the way. And I'm sure you want to be able to have a decent return, and you've got to get on a plane and pay your cost for marketing and hire people to work for you and be able to reward them too. So it's a challenge that people, if they get the story, hopefully they'll recognize that you know, they're getting a lot for the money. So, and that leads to a final question I want to ask you, and that is that you're an unlikely farmer. I mean, you get, everybody can tell we're talking here, and you've got perfect English. You've told me you lived quite a few years in Oklahoma. You don't have an Oklahoma accent, but you get perfect no accent. I can't tell that you speak Spanish most of the time, and you've got an MBA. So many would say you may not be a typical farmer, but you are a farmer. And as you look down the road, what's your hope for the next 4 or 5 years? Other than just the price, but if you're seeing something develop that's good for you as a coffee farmer, what might that be?
Well, and yes, I definitely am fully aware, and I know I have been privileged to have been able to have access to the education I had and the upbringing, and I can get that Southern drawl in there if I need to.
There you go.
But so yes, I know I am unusual in that sense. But my hope definitely is that the topic of sustainable farming, and like you were saying, whether that's in coffee or any other of our food items, that gets more ingrained in the mind of the consumer, and we actually start to think where things are coming from and what it takes to actually, you know, get the stuff into our table, or in this case, into the coffee shop. And so that other farmers that are not like me, well, at least they can hope and dream to eventually at least give their children some of the privileges that I have been blessed to have.
Well, I think that is a good thing to aspire to. And I would just put in a plug for your coffee, Nell, too. And that is saying that pay attention to where the coffee comes from. See what it is that you're interested in. You see something from Guatemala, it just might be coming from Juan Luis Barrios. So, Juan, thank you very much for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.